This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Like it or not, the next year and a half in America will be dominated by a historic race for president. And a big part of that conversation will be the struggle for the face of American conservatism. The Republican Party has done lots of self-reflection after two losses to Barack Obama. They've talked about remaking a party as more inclusive, less anti-immigrant, and less anti-gay. A party that needs to come to grips with its own past support for military interventionism and where that can lead. So we'll hear from maybe 20 candidates for that nomination, putting their spin on what they think the future of conservatism looks like. But in general, the same rules will apply to all contenders. Without calls for smaller government and lower taxes, without support for gun rights and a vague appeal to family values, they will be unlikely to gain much traction. Meanwhile, overseas, European conservatives, faced with many of the same problems of perception and electability, are making inroads. But there are still some pretty stark differences between what the right looks like here and over there. Today, Where We Live, local experts help to decode conservative movements in the UK and France. We'll also talk about a comeback for Scottish nationalists and consider what the Irish gay marriage vote can tell us about that country's politics. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll start in France, where the country's third largest party, the National Front, or FN, is gaining ground, and where that party's leader, Marine Le Pen, is trying to rally around a sense of French nationalism.
Again, our countries are under threat. And when your country's under threat, you have to rise above your own concerns and construct a single force. There's no more left or right. There are nationalists and globalists. That's the big demarcation line that determines the fate of the world today.
Here to talk about modern French conservatism is David Cameron. He's professor of political science and director of EU studies at Yale. He joins us from the Yale studios in New Haven today. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also joining us by phone is Art Goldhammer. He's based at the Center for European Studies at Harvard. He has a blog called French Politics. And again, he joins us today by phone. And Art, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Art, let me start with you, and maybe you can just set up for our listeners who don't probably follow French politics all that closely. Explain what exactly the National Front is and how perhaps they may seem like or unlike the American Republican Party.
Well, I would say that the National Front is not in any sense a conservative party. So in a sense, I'm disputing the premise of your program. It's a party, a radical party of the extreme right, a populist party, and a nationalist party. Just how radical it is depends to some extent on your angle of view and whether you're looking at the leadership or the rank and file. On a whole series of issues, it has positions that are radically at odds with the parties of the center-right and center-left, which have been traditionally dominant in French politics. It's radically opposed to immigration and Islam. It's radically anti-EU and anti-Euro, wants to withdraw from the Euro. It's a protectionist party. Traditionally, the Front National has been associated with anti-Semitism, but that aspect of its politics has been downplayed considerably since Marine Le Pen took over the leadership of the party from her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, almost 4 years ago. The party also has a very radical history in that it draws on the extreme right opposition to decolonization and to General de Gaulle and the institutionalization of the Fifth Republic, which goes back some 50 years now. So its original nucleus was the violent extreme right in France. But today's party does not have that violent reputation. Marine Le Pen has changed its aspect in some respects, and as the French press likes to say, she's de-demonized the party and separated it from the street brawler image that was associated with her father. Yet one final remark, the Front National supports the welfare state. In France, about 57% of GDP is accounted for by government spending. And unlike the American Republican Party, which wants to roll back the welfare state to pre-FDR levels, there's no such attitude in France or in large part across Europe. The welfare state is well supported in Europe, and the Front National, if elected, has no intention of reducing the large government spending in France.
And so, of course, there's a big differentiator right there. American political observers can't imagine a radical right that would support a welfare state. But perhaps first, what we need to do is provide a little context for American politics. This is completely a bipolar system. We have Republicans and Democrats, and many complain that because we don't have more parties, we don't have more types of thought. Those two parties have merged together into almost one with very few differences. Maybe part of the context, Art, is to explain how many major parties there are and where they fall on this very broad political spectrum.
Right. Well, the French system is very different. The presidential election is a two-round affair in which only two candidates make it to the second round, but many candidates can run in the first round. So until now, French politics has been dominated by a center-right and a center-left party. The center-left party, which is currently in power, is called the Socialist Party, but in many ways it's departed from any traditional definition of socialism, and its politics now resemble the politics of the Democratic Party in the United States. The center-right party, until a week ago, was called the Union for a Popular Majority, but it just changed its name to the Republicans, not in emulation of the American Republican Party, but as a gesture toward the importance of Republican symbolism in France, going back to the French Revolution when the First Republic was declared. We're now on the Fifth Republic, whose constitution was adopted in 1962. So those are the two major parties. Also on the left, there is a party called the Left Front, the Front de Gauche, which was founded by Jean-Luc Mélenchon and includes the rump of the old Communist Party and some dissidents from the left wing of the Socialist Party. And then there are some smaller parties on the left, and there is also a Green Party, which situates itself on most issues on the left. On the right, on the extreme right, you have the Front National, and then some very small extreme right-wing parties and a Nationalist Party. So there are really four significant parties and then a sprinkling of splinter parties.
So why right now in French history is this extreme right FN party gaining ground? Why indeed is it potentially poised to make even more inroads into French political life?
Well, there are two reasons. The first is the economic crisis, and the second is that in the perception of many French voters, you now have two failed presidencies. First Nicolas Sarkozy's, and now François Hollande's. So the financial crisis, which began a little later in Europe than here, has exacerbated a longstanding economic problem in France, which is a high level of unemployment. Unemployment had started to decrease a bit under Sarkozy in the first couple of years. But then the economic crisis hit, and unemployment is now up in the 11 to 12% range and has not decreased. François Hollande has said that he will not be a candidate in 2017 to succeed himself unless he can succeed in turning down the curve of unemployment. And so far, he has been unable to do that. That has made him extremely unpopular. I just saw a poll this morning that shows that 67% of the French say they will not vote for Hollande for re-election under any circumstances, which is an extraordinary level of negatives, even higher than Marine Le Pen's negatives. So that's will be a crisis for the Socialist Party. And when Sarkozy left office in 2012, after being defeated by Hollande, he was also extremely unpopular, even though he made a bit of a comeback in the election, was not defeated by that larger percentage. There was a severe rejection of his presidency. So failed presidency and economic crisis, I think, account for the rise of the Front National. And then one has to mention the sheer political skill of Marine Le Pen. Whatever one thinks of her politics, she's a very skilled politician.
We're talking with Art Goldhammer, who is based at the Center for European Studies at Harvard. He's also a writer and a translator into English of several books. He has a blog called French Politics. We're talking today about European politics, European conservatism specifically, how it might compare to that we see in the U.S. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let me bring in David Cameron from Yale University, who studies the EU, and ask you, David, what trends you see in this movement in France. This, as Art says, maybe the rise of a party based on economic crisis, based on some very shrewd political moves. Are there other trends in French life that you think might be contributing to the rise of the right there?
Well, I think one of the important trends has been the growth of immigration, and Front National has a strong xenophobic appeal that can be tracked back to the era in the late 50s with the migration from Northern Africa of settlers and others. And we see this immigration crisis, migration crisis, most vividly in the Mediterranean right now. But I think one of the things that has to be pointed out about Front National is that if you look at the European Union Parliament vote last spring, which in a sense was a free vote for the French, it didn't have any impact on French politics directly. Front National won that election, won in the high 20% range in that election. And I think a lot of that is a reflection of the fact that both the center-right party of Sarkozy and the center-left government under Hollande have not done a very good job in dealing with the economic crisis, with unemployment. They've both followed austerity policies, so the only strong opposition to austerity is coming not from the left, as in Greece or Spain, or the new left in Greece and Spain, but from Front National. Another strong element in Front National's appeal is the Euroscepticism, and there's an enormous amount of Euroscepticism throughout Europe. And we see it in obviously in the UK, but in many other countries as well, in Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Netherlands, so forth. So both of those are factors. Another factor we have to point to, I think, that's important is that Marine Le Pen has, in some sense, cleaned up the Front National, and in fact, symbolically removed her father from Front National recently. And so Front National is now attracting support, like it or not, from across the spectrum of voters by occupation, status, economic situation, and so forth. And she's been very strategic in that. And that has obviously implications for 2017. Recent poll results show that François Hollande is probably the fourth preference for 2017. There are two conservative or center-right candidates, Alain Juppé and Sarkozy, and Marine Le Pen, who are all in the high 20 to low 30% range in the surveys. Some of that is reflects her political ability, which is, I think most observers would say, far surpasses that of her father.
Art Goldhammer, how much is the FN right now defined by the anti-immigrant policies that you mentioned earlier? How much of its appeal stems from that?
Well, a good deal of its appeal stems from that. And in fact, anti-immigrant feeling is the single best predictor statistically of a vote for the Front National. In fact, it's anti-immigrant sentiment that I think explains why the opposition to austerity is centered in the Front National rather than the extreme left, as in Spain and Greece. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the leader of the extreme left party in France, is very friendly with Alexis Tsipras, the leader of Syriza, invited Tsipras to France during the presidential campaign and so on. In initial polls in 2012, he was doing fairly well against Marine Le Pen, whom he had made his chief enemy. But he began to fade because it was clear that he was not as adamantly opposed to the EU and the euro, the euroscepticism sentiment that is very strong in Europe, as David Cameron mentioned, and also because he is not as anti-immigrant. He's not at all anti-immigrant. So voters who were inclined to take the anti-immigrant view chose the extreme right rather than the extreme left to represent their views.
As a last question for you, Art, I'd like you to just walk through some of the complicated political feelings in France surrounding the Charlie Hebdo attacks. We look at it from America in some ways very much like our own 9/11. Some of the very pro-patriotic reaction here is something that many Americans felt very comfortable with at the time, even if they felt maybe less comfortable as time wore on. But that attack seems to have also galvanized certain feelings about Islam, about immigration, and about French nationalism that probably will extend beyond just a few years or just the memory of that attack.
Yes, that's a very good observation. It's quite true that there was a massive reaction on January 11th, the Sunday that followed the attacks in France. There was the largest public demonstration in French history, which brought some 4 million people into the streets across France. And this has led to a number of reactions, particularly on the security front. The French, who had been quite vocal in attacking the United States for adopting the Patriot Act, have now adopted a similar act of their own, allowing for much more extensive electronic surveillance in France. Although the politicians who adopted this act keep saying that it's nothing like the American Patriot Act. In fact, when you look at the details, I think it gives even more extensive powers to the government. And here in the United States, there's been some recent turn away from granting such extensive powers. But in France, rather surprisingly, the reaction to the Charlie Hebdo attacks was extremely strong. I say surprisingly because 9/11 came as more of a shock in the United States. We're used to being insulated from what goes on in the rest of the world, separated physically, geographically by oceans from hostile countries. Whereas France has suffered a number of terrorist attacks that have claimed numerous lives over the years. So in some ways, it should have been less of a surprise in France. But for whatever reason, this recent attack has had a much more direct impact on French emotions.
Art Goldhammer is based at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University. He's also a writer, translator into English of several books, including Thomas Piketty's recent Capital in the 21st Century. He writes a blog called French Politics. He joined us today by phone. Art, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Very quickly, David Cameron, but before we move on from France to the UK, I'm wondering how this rise in French nationalism, how this plays in the rest of Europe, how Germany and the other large countries in Europe feel about whether it's the FN or just the growing sentiment that that a more isolationist France is becoming popular there.
I think the one thing we have to understand about France is that France and Germany have had a very close relationship for the last 60-plus years. In fact, they are the two countries that agreed to start what would later become the European Community and European Union. The French center-right has taken a, under Jacques Chirac in particular, has taken a very strategic view of creating a barrier between itself and the Front National. So the Europeans, I think most of the Europeans understand where the Front National is coming from. It's no different in some sense from the extreme right parties that we see in Scandinavia and in other countries. But Front National is clearly Eurosceptic, notwithstanding the paradoxical fact that Marine Le Pen is a member of the European Parliament. I think, as Art Goldhammer said, part of the appeal of the Front National is frustration with the performance of both the center-right and the center-left in France on economic issues, on issues of globalization, on issues of migration, on issues of democracy. That's an appeal that that attracts many supporters, and not just people who would call themselves or we would call members of the extreme right.
We're talking with David Cameron, who's professor of political science and director of EU studies at Yale University. Today on the program, we're talking about European conservatism. Later on in the show, we'll be talking about the recent gay marriage vote in Ireland. If you have questions about European politics, 860-275-7266. We will hop across the pond, as they say, and talk about the UK elections coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking with local experts about European politics. If you consider yourself a global citizen, someone who knows their geography, their world leaders, and international trivia, hope you can join me tonight at the Polish National Home in Hartford for World Quest 2015. It's a program of the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. It's a fun trivia contest I've been hosting for years. And even if you don't think you're an expert, well, at least you can get pierogies and beer. Check out our Where We Live Facebook page for more.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a majority conservative government.
That's David Cameron, British Prime Minister, after a resounding conservative victory in May. Today we're trying to see what we can learn about conservative movements in Europe with David Cameron, Professor of Political Science and Director of EU Studies at Yale University. Let's just get this out of the way, Professor, first. How confusing is it for you or your students to be taught by David Cameron about David Cameron?
It's a bit confusing, but I tell them that's the David Cameron with hair. It turns out David is a very frequent first name of sons of Camerons who put a value on their Scottish heritage, and it all goes back to King David the First, who was perhaps the greatest state builder in medieval Scotland. So there are many David Camerons. In fact, there are David Camerons at Yale, to the point where, as your producer knows, Yale has to differentiate my name with the middle initial. So I've been living with this for a long time.
You've been living with this for a long time. I figured we might as well ask, and I'm sure that you get it an awful lot. I didn't know how common David was as a name for Camerons, but there you go. So the election results that happened in the UK, NPR, for instance, was building up to this election and breathlessly reported about what could be a very, very close vote. And then the next day, seemingly, everything for the Labour Party had just crumbled. Why this resounding conservative victory in the UK elections earlier in May?
Well, we shouldn't blame NPR about it. It was really the polls. And all of the polls more or less got two big developments right. The fact that the SNP would do very well in Scotland, and the fact that the Liberal Democrats would collapse or nearly collapse and lose almost all of their seats. What the polls didn't get is that in England and Wales, where 570 plus of the 650 seats in the House of Commons are located, that the Conservatives would actually do quite well and do better than Labour. And So what happened was that the Liberals and Labour, especially in Scotland, lost almost all of their seats. Labour lost a huge number in Scotland. The Liberals lost all of their seats in England, and the Conservatives got most of those seats. So if one had taken a more disaggregated view of what was going on in the election, I think the polls would have said, rather than what we were all being told at the time, that there'll be a hung parliament, that there's roughly the same national vote between Conservatives and Labour. And there'll be a hung parliament, and a hung parliament might mean a Labour minority, which might govern with the SNP. I think that was the view that most commentators had going into the election, and probably the one that was being picked up in your NPR programs. Had the polls differentiated this a bit, they would have seen that actually the Conservatives would do pretty well in England and Wales, and that would give them the margin. So they actually came out of the election with a majority.
In the first segment of our program, as we talked about French politics, we heard about some of these paradoxes, at least to American political observers, paradoxes like the far-right Front National Party being the anti-austerity party. Essentially, we would think of American Republicans being all for austerity, but that's not the case in France. It's just one of the many paradoxes there. Maybe you can explain a little bit about what modern British conservatism looks like, how it may be in some ways the same or in some ways very different from what we see in the Republican Party here.
Well, it's an interesting it's a different kind of conservatism, I think. But we also have to say that it varies a bit. There are leaders who are much more Reagan-esque, Margaret Thatcher epitomizing that. The first thing Margaret Thatcher did was substantially reduce the income tax, similar to what Reagan did, and that had profound effects on the economy and also on the degree of inequality that we've been observing ever since. But there are other conservatives. One could go back to Harold Macmillan and Edward Heath, and more recently, I think, David Cameron, who are a little more inclined to move to the center-right space rather than the right, and in some sense take a view that you win the elections by competing for the middle. That was something Tony Blair taught the Labour Party, rather than going to the wings. The problem David Cameron has had, of course, is that there's a very strong right-wing party, UKIP, United Kingdom Independence Party, which is Eurosceptic and which wants to leave the EU, which has attracted considerable support on the right wing of the Conservative Party in a number of the constituencies, and in fact has attracted a few defectors from the Conservative MPs. So Cameron has had to deal with that threat to his right flank, you might say. Mm. But I think coming out of the election, one got a sense from the way he spoke after the election that he was very much positioning himself as someone who was closer to the middle, or at least the center part of the center right, and appealing to the entire country and speaking of one nation.
You mentioned Margaret Thatcher, and I wanted to ask you about that because as we watch maybe 15 or 20 Republican candidates vie for the nomination, all they need to do is essentially put a picture of Ronald Reagan on the screen behind them and say, here is how I want to be like that man. He's essentially the guide star for the Republican Party, to the point where many Republican candidates even overlook some of his actual policies because he is seen as the standard bearer for conservatism in America. Is Thatcher still seen that way by conservatives in the UK?
I think she is. Certainly within the Conservative Party, there are many Thatcherites still. But on the other hand, I think there are also there's a younger generation now, or we're maybe two generations removed from Thatcher now, so that someone like George Osborne, for example, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, actually ran quite a substantial budget deficit through the crisis over the last 5 years. While they spoke about austerity, they were nevertheless running a fairly substantial deficit, considerably in excess of what the Eurozone countries were required to implement. And as a result, the UK has done quite well and come out of the crisis. In that sense, they're a little more pragmatic, a little less ideological, I think, than the Reagan, than Thatcher and Reagan were.
A last thing for you before we move on to our next conversation about European politics. You mentioned the SNP, the Scottish National Party, and one of the big storylines, not only of this most recent election, was the resounding success that they had, but also the big comeback that they've had since the failed vote for Scottish independence. Can we attribute this, David Cameron, this comeback for the SNP?
Well, I think I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that in the UK there are single member districts, constituencies. The SNP got about 45% in the referendum last September. They lost. The 55% were mobilized by three parties, the Labour Party, Conservative Party, and Liberal Democratic parties grouped together in a Better Together coalition. That's what they call their campaign. They got 55%. But if you divide up that 55% three ways and put that against SNP's 45%, then even if the SNP hadn't done better than they did last September, we would have predicted that they would take almost all of the seats. And indeed they did. They took 56 of the 59 Scottish constituencies. They did a little better than that, in fact, in the election. And that, I think that was in part the weakness of the Labour Party campaign. Ed Miliband was, from my point of view, completely ineffective as a campaign leader. Labour did terribly. They lost 40 seats. They had been by far the largest party in Scotland. So there was a bad campaign. SNP's referendum campaign last September, although they lost, one of the things that's interesting is that it brought a wave of new people, new activists into the SNP. The membership more than quadrupled from 25,000 to more than 110,000. You may remember there was a 20-year-old Scottish university student who won election to the MP as an MP, the youngest MP ever elected. She came into the campaign last September. So the SNP, the mobilization last September brought in new people, new activists, built their ground game. In addition to that, you have to say that Nicola Sturgeon, who is now the first minister and leader of the SNP, turned out to be the most telegenic, charismatic, and appealing leader of any of the parties in Scotland.
Well, and of course, and that's something that gets back to something we hear about in American politics all the time. We can talk about policies and we can talk about vision, but when you get right down to it, if you have a telegenic, good candidate, that is something that you always want. As we talked about in France as well, Marine Le Pen, you might not like some of the politics, but she turns out to be a pretty good candidate. So we're learning a little bit something about European conservatism and European politics. We're going to move across to Ireland now, where another historic vote recently took place, a vote to legalize gay marriage. That's coming up next, Where We Live.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, is scientific progress suffering from a lack of innovation? We'll talk to the author of The Creativity Crisis, Reinventing Science to Unleash Possibility. We're also going to be looking at an interesting scientific discovery, a new material called Vantablack, why it's being called the darkest material ever made, a little Science Friday edition of Where We Live. That's coming up tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
I don't believe society is changing. I believe it's been hijacked.
Tom Leonard is sitting outside the pub on this sunny spring day.
If they want to live together, they want to have some kind of a civil ceremony together, that's fine. But they have to come up with their own word for that. I object strongly to the term marriage. That is for men and for women.
That's from a report by NPR's Ari Shapiro covering a historic vote in Ireland that legalized gay marriage. As we consider conservatism in Europe today, we wanted to know what this vote tells us about politics in Ireland. Joining us now is Mary Burke. She's associate professor and director of Irish literature concentration at UConn Storrs. Mary, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted to be here, John.
First of all, maybe you can give us a brief summary of the referendum and the result of the referendum.
Sure. So in 1993, Ireland was among the last countries in the Western world to decriminalize homosexuality. And only 22 years later, it has just become the first to legalize same-sex marriage by popular vote. So social change has been very, very rapid in recent decades. So Irish voters were asked in May of 2015 whether they agreed with the statement, marriage may be contracted in accordance with the law by two persons without distinction as to their sex. So the yes vote prevailed, and the breakdown was 62% in favor of same-sex marriage, 38% against.
And I'll just stop you and say, the way that that question is worded seems convoluted, but I assumed everyone knew what they were voting for?
Yes, there didn't seem to be any confusion. At least nobody complained.
So 60% turnout or so, you say?
That's right. 60% turnout of just over 3 million eligible voters, which was a much higher turnout than most referenda in Ireland. So in terms of sort of voting patterns, the Yes campaign swept wealthier urban constituencies. Working class urban voters who tend to lean left but tend not to vote in elections and whose church attendance rate is 2%. These working class urban voters actually also turned out in large numbers and voted yes in large numbers. The no vote was strongest in rural areas where church attendance figures, of course, tend to be higher. That said, and I should stress this, only one out of Ireland's 43 constituencies returned a no vote in the count. The margin was tight in many rural areas, but the yes vote did prevail almost universally. But
when you say the no vote was strongest in rural areas where church attendance figures tend to be higher, not terribly surprising, was there a specific message coming from the pulpit in those rural areas to voters?
Yes. You know, the members of the Irish media and Irish celebrities overwhelmingly advocated for the yes vote, but obviously the Catholic Church, unsurprisingly, and something called the Iona Institute advocated a no vote. And I can explain who they are.
Yeah, no, but please do. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what the no vote argument was. I mean, what were people saying?
Sure. So the no campaign's rhetoric talked about children being forced to grow up deprived of either a mother or a father. And there was a lot of deflection to the issue of gay parents and adoption and gay parents and their reliance on surrogate pregnancy. So to get back to the Iona Institute and sort of the specifics of what they said. So they're a socially conservative Catholic advocacy group. They have a handful of very high profile journalist members, and they were a major player. Members cited certain quite contentious American studies to back their claims that children do best when raised by a mother and father. And in terms of, say, the Catholic authorities, the Bishop Kevin Doran, he stated on live radio in Ireland that gay people raising children were not real parents, as children need a mother and father. And there was a very vocal response to that.
And that, in many ways, echoes a lot of the conversation that is had in America. Perhaps it gets outside of the church in some of the public sphere in America in that way. But the arguments sound very similar, at least in the sense of what a real marriage is.
Right. They're similar, but however, we shouldn't assume that this was an American-style fractious culture war. On the whole, the debate was civil, despite that. The morning after the referendum, I was very struck when I heard one of the main organizers of the No campaign tell a national broadcast that he would attend a gay wedding in the future, should he be asked. So there was a kind of a grace in defeat, I think that was heartening.
You know, as we talk about the referendum in favor of gay marriage in Ireland, as we consider conservatism and politics in Europe today in the program, you can join us at 860-275-7266. You know, I read a story in The Guardian, I believe, recently about this vote, and it was, for supporters of gay marriage worldwide, an overwhelming victory. This was tempered somewhat in this article by the sense of, well, this is something that Irish voters can get behind. If we started talking about abortion rights, that might be a very, very different thing. Do you see it that way?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, and that was stated by the Yes lobby immediately after the vote, was that our next battle is in terms of the abortion issue. I think Ireland is much more secular than it used to be, but the core kind of Catholic teaching remains in place when it comes to the issue of abortion. Mm.
One of the things that we wanted to do with this program is actually try to better understand places that we may just see headlines about, right? We think we know a little bit about what conservatism or liberalism means in the UK or France. In the lead up to this vote, this referendum vote in Ireland, I think an awful lot of the American media conversation was, well, this is this overwhelmingly Catholic country that could not possibly tolerate gay marriage. But it's, from what you're describing, a much more nuanced conversation, a very much more nuanced political debate in Ireland than many people observing from this side of the Atlantic might have thought.
Right. Yeah. The constituency of the No Party is kind of fascinating. So in the lead up, as you said, to the referendum, I think the older generation were assumed to be the No constituency. But this proved to be true only to a certain extent, because the difference between conservative and liberal is not as clear cut in Ireland as in the US. Ireland has been dominated by two centre-right parties since the 1930s, and they've repeatedly gone into coalition with smaller centre-left parties. This forces them to be moderate and to reflect the broad middle. So contemporary Irish economic policies align with centrist American views, but social policy would be considered very liberal by US standards. Now, an extraordinary fact is that all the political parties in Ireland, left and right, supported the yes vote in the same-sex referendum. So there was a kind of a consensus there.
I want to bring back in David Cameron from Yale University, who's a professor of political science and director of EU studies there, to maybe give us a sense, David, of how Ireland fits into the modern European Union, how they fit into the Europe that we've been talking about sitting down in France and the UK.
Just taking this issue, I think one of the things we have to recognize is that a number of European countries have same-sex marriage and have provided for that through legislation. Ireland is the first country in the world that did it by a referendum. But about 15 or so European countries, Western European countries, have already legislated that. So, in some sense, Ireland is catching up with the rest of Europe on this. What makes it unique, of course, is that well over 80% of the population are Catholic, and it has a very strong hierarchy. But we have to take into account the fact that that hierarchy and indeed the religion has been called into question by the pedophile scandals and the cover-ups that have existed not only in Ireland, but certainly in Ireland. The other thing I think that's worth noting is that same-sex marriage is something that is happening here as well as elsewhere. We have four cases now before the Supreme Court that will be decided later this month dealing with same-sex marriage. We have 37 of the states and D.C. that have approved same-sex marriage, and interestingly, 27 of those have occurred in the last 3 years. So in some sense, Ireland is catching up with Europe, and we are as well.
And Mary, it sounds from what David's saying too, is this is Ireland as part of, it's a real global conversation about these issues. It's something that's happening in that country in a very specific way, but it's also a global conversation across Europe and here in America as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was talk of sort of American money coming in on both sides in the Irish referendum. So definitely there's an awareness of the broader conversation in Ireland.
I want to quickly get to a phone call from Paul. Hi, Paul. You're calling from East Hartford. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, I am. I just wanted to say that there have been very few calls coming in from the general public, but it's because we really know nothing about these topics, so you know, we don't have a lot to say. It's more of a learning experience, but I think it's been terrific, and I hope you have more shows like this.
Oh, Paul, thank you very much for that. And you know, Mary, as someone who obviously follows what is happening in Ireland very, very closely, is that a sense that you get, that we are disconnected from these places that are so very important to us, places like Ireland, the UK, all across continental Europe? We don't tend to know very much about the politics, about the distinctions, and we paint everything with a very American brush.
I suppose, yeah. I'm a literature professor, and I do find that when I teach contemporary Irish literature from the last 20 years, which often deals with these issues, the students are very shocked sometimes by the image of Ireland, even 18th century literature, which is very, very open about issues of sexuality, is the students are very surprised that these kind of voices were ever heard in Ireland.
Aside from some of the things we've talked about specifically, how else do you think, Mary, Ireland is changing, and how rapidly?
Oh, very rapidly. So, I mean, rising levels of education and wealth go hand in hand with liberalization and secularization, I think, in Europe in a way that maybe hasn't always been true in the US. So in recent decades, a number of factors have transformed Ireland. So this liberalization, which is arguably tied to Ireland's open economy, it's secularized hugely. Again, as David mentioned, this has been hastened by clerical sexual abuse scandals. We elected two women presidents. There's the greater availability of free education means there's an enormous chasm between generations, and an economic boom in the millennium period that saw the young and the liberal stay put, and saw also an influx of new cultures with the inward immigration that occurred during that boom.
Is immigration from the outside, from North Africa, from the Middle East, from other parts of Europe, is that happening at as rapid a pace in Ireland as it is in some of the other countries we've talked about?
Well, it has slowed down, with the bust that occurred when America gets a cold, Ireland gets the flu economically. Yeah. So we had a pretty bad time.
People don't come there when they can't make money there, and that's what was happening. Yes.
Nonetheless, with that huge influx, obviously a certain proportion of people stayed. And what was very interesting in terms of the debate was that some of the immigrant cohort, particularly the African cohort, the evangelical African cohort, made common cause with the right-wing Catholic lobby in terms of the no advocacy lobby during the referendum.
Could you imagine in Ireland, a more economically strong Ireland that attracts more people from around the world, beginning to gain more of a nationalistic feel of the type that we've seen in other European countries?
Certainly, there was a referendum in 2004 on who qualified to be an Irish citizenship in terms of being born in Ireland. And that was widely interpreted as an anti-immigrant referendum. There was an awful lot of very nasty rhetoric about pregnant African women inundating Irish maternity wards during that referendum. So this broad sort of liberalisation in Ireland isn't a straightforward forward momentum at all times. You know, when it comes to economic self-interest, the Irish can regress quite quickly.
And it's what's been funny about our conversation, very interesting to me, is so many of these paradoxes, so many things that seem like they should go in a straight line and very much don't. Mary Burke is an associate professor and director of Irish literature concentration at UConn Stores. Thank you so much for spending some time with us and talking about this historic vote. I really appreciate it.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Also, I want to thank David Cameron. He's a professor of political science and director of EU studies at Yale University in New Haven. He joined us today from the Yale studios. David, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Our program was produced today by Jules Lefebvre. Also, Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. If you enjoyed this conversation, hope you can join us at the World Affairs Council World Quest Trivia Night. It happens at the Polish National Home at 6 o'clock tonight. If you want to find out more information about that, go to our Where We Live Facebook page. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.